Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. I don't think of myself as a liberal at all, Justice John Paul Stevens told one of my guests today just a couple of years ago. But Justice Stevens has certainly been leader of the Supreme Court's embattled liberal wing. Now, with the news that Stevens will retire this summer, anticipation has rocketed over who comes next and what it may mean for American life and law. This hour on Point, the legacy of Justice John Paul Stevens, how the court will change, and the confirmation ahead. Joining me first today from Washington is Jan Crawford, legal correspondent for CBS News, where she also writes the Crossroads blog. She's author of Supreme Conflict, the inside story of the struggle for control of the United States Supreme Court. Jan Crawford, it's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here, as always.
Wonderful to have you. Remind us of the basics first. When does Justice Stevens leave? Where will that be in the cycle of the court's work? What's the calendar?
Well, what Justice Stevens did was give the president a good heads up so he can start working on his nominee, but he's not going to officially step down from the court until the end of its term, which usually is at the very end of June. So these hearings for his successor will not start until the middle of the summer. But he went ahead and told the White House, now almost like a steward of the court and its future, so that the White House could go ahead and get started on replacing him, which is no easy task.
Mm. So remind us, when will President Obama likely put forward a name for a nominee to replace the Justice Stevens?
The timing is kind of tricky. They don't want to give Republicans too much lead time, because then your nominee can become a punching bag in those weeks before the hearing. They will do this before Memorial Day. That's what my sources are telling me. They nominated Sonia Sotomayor on May 26 last year. So I would expect a nominee sometime in early to mid-May. That would give the Senate plenty of time to get their questionnaires together and start meeting this potential candidate. But it also is not too much time. So they're walking a little fine line there.
We'll look at who may be on that short list, Jen. What about Justice Stevens himself, the role that he's come to play? And the place maybe is where he began. I mean, here he is out of Chicago all the way back in 1975, nominated to the court by Gerald Ford, one of the longest-serving justices in the history of the Supreme Court. What's the role that he evolved into over those years?
Well, Justice Stevens was nominated off the Seventh Circuit Federal Court of Appeals from Chicago, and he was seen as someone and was someone of utmost integrity. He'd investigated corrupt judges in Illinois. He was a Navy veteran. And President Ford was looking for a nominee of that caliber because, remember, the country was coming out of the tumult of Watergate, and the court needed someone who was really a symbol of great integrity. And that was the role that Justice Stevens played as a nominee, and certainly a suggestion. And as you pointed out as the show started, I interviewed him 3 years ago, and he insisted that he had remained the same conservative that he was when President Ford put him on that court. I question that because there are key areas where he clearly has changed over the years, but he always did serve as this kind of independent voice. He's fiercely independent. He wore those little bow ties. He had a sparkle in his eye all the time, even from the bench. He was very courtly when asking very pointed questions. One of my favorite stories about Justice Stevens, and I think this shows his fierce independence, is tradition calls for when the justices, right before they take the bench, will meet in what's called the robing room, and their black robes are in kind of like a locker. It's like a locker room for justices.
More or less.
So tradition, I don't think you'd have the same humor, but at any rate, so tradition has it that an aide will help the other justices put their robes on, but not Justice Stevens. He always insisted on doing that himself, and I think that's kind of how he saw the law as well. He doesn't have a particularly, I think, clear judicial philosophy that you could really talk about. He forged his own path in many ways.
Not a clear philosophy. I've read him object to that characterization, but he's clearly characterized by all as the leader of what is now the liberal minority, liberal wing of the court.
That's exactly right. And that's an important role that he plays. He would speak, and it doesn't sound like a big deal, but when the justices sit around this big wooden table in their private conferences, and that's when they're talking about how they're going to vote on decisions after the arguments, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, obviously a strong conservative, would start the conversation off. And then it goes to the senior justice. This would, of course, have been John Paul Stevens. So he would be able to give the counterpoint to John Roberts. That role will now fall to Antonin Scalia, another conservative. Also is the senior justice from that liberal wing. Justice Stevens assigns the opinions when the liberals are in the majority. That's an important thing because you kind of have to be calculating. You saw him assign some key opinions to, say, Justice O'Connor when she was on the court, a more moderate conservative, but she often voted with the liberals on some social issues. So that role now will be vastly different. And he did take all those decisions very seriously, of course, and quite effective he was.
Jan, please stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation, also from Washington, Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University. He's author of The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. He's looked closely at the high court and Justice Stevens' role. Jay Rosen, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Great to be here.
So let me put the same sort of conundrum to you. Here we have a justice, and you quoted him along the same lines, a justice who is seen as leader of the liberal wing of the court, and yet when you ask him, he says, "I'm a judicial conservative." What does Justice Stevens mean by that?
He really insists on this. I interviewed him around the same time as Jan, mm-hmm. and he just kept saying, "I think as my general politics, I'm pretty darn conservative. He's economically conservative and so forth. But mostly he considers himself a judicial conservative, and he was struck by the fact that he thinks that not a single justice who joined the court that he was on in 1975 would have been with the current conservative majority. He thinks that everyone who's been appointed to the court since the 1970s has been more conservative than his or her predecessor, except maybe Justice Ginsburg. And in his view, what a judicial conservative should do is defer to the political branches. It's striking, isn't it, that right after President Obama said that he would nominate a new justice, as soon as Justice Stevens resigned, Republicans said he has to appoint a restrained justice. He can't appoint an activist. Senator Hatch promised mm-hmm. there'd be a whale of a fight if he appointed an activist to the court. And Senator McConnell said the same thing. But what is the definition of activism that Hatch and McConnell embrace? It's essentially, in their view, judges are activists if they refuse to strike down federal laws, like campaign finance and health care, that Hatch, McConnell, and other Republicans unsuccessfully opposed. It's a kind of Alice in Wonderland definition where they're pledging to vote against any nominee who won't promise to strike down the laws that they, you know, lost in the Senate, which is really what conservatives had accused liberals of doing for the past 50 years. And for Stevens, he buys into that post-New Deal vision of judicial restraint. He thinks that policy should be made in Congress, not in the courts. He was quite deferential to economic regulation. And it's true, as Jan said, he's hard to categorize, but he did have a judicial philosophy of sorts. He thought that government neutrality was very important. He said, "I think it's very important for the government to be impartial." And it was that idea that united his opinions in Clinton v. Jones, where he said you could have oversight of executive power, of affirmative action, where he initially had been skeptical of some forms of federal affirmative action, but he came to support it when he thought that it was neutral, and abortion, where he alone thought that restrictions on abortion might violate the separation of church and state, that basically the government had an obligation not to be sectarian and couldn't impose religious views on the country. So that idea of neutrality, which really came from his background, where he was he made his name fighting corruption in Chicago and was the lead investigator in a judicial corruption investigation where a judge was supposed to have taken a bribe in exchange for throwing a case. And that convinced Stevens both that government has to be neutral and also that dissents are really important. He thought that if the judge in that case had filed a separate dissent, the scandal might have gone away. And as a result, Stevens has filed more dissenting opinions than any of his colleagues on the Supreme Court.
His own family owned what at one time was the biggest hotel in the world in Chicago, 3,000 rooms. His father ended up convicted of embezzlement and then those charges thrown out or reversed by an appellate court there. Here's President Obama on Friday in the Rose Garden talking about replacing Justice Stevens.
"While we cannot replace Justice Stevens' experience or wisdom, I will seek someone in the coming weeks with similar qualities, an independent mind, a record of excellence and integrity, a fierce dedication to the rule of law, and a keen understanding of how the law affects the daily lives of the American people. It will also be someone who, like Justice Stevens, knows that in a democracy, powerful interests must not be allowed to drown out the voices of ordinary citizens.
President Obama on Friday. Jan, what's he talking about in that line, powerful interests must not be allowed to drown out the voices of ordinary citizens?
Well, that was the key line of his entire remarks when he was talking about Justice Stevens' retirement. That, and we're going to see that the White House continue to beat that drum. If I could just say, let me just kind of give some context to this. This retirement in some ways comes at a very difficult time for the Democrats and the White House. Any moment now that they have to spend not talking about jobs and the economy and selling what is really an unpopular health care plan is in some ways a boon for Republicans. So one way they're going to try to get around that is, as I said, to beat the drum that the Supreme Court is out of touch with everyday Americans. And we started seeing this narrative back in the State of the Union address. If you remember, when President Obama took what really was in modern times an unprecedented swipe at the Supreme Court for its recent ruling on campaign finance reform. As you recall, it struck down a key part of the campaign finance reform legislation and said that corporations and unions could spend unlimited amounts on political advertisements all the way up till the very end and right before the election.
And they will. They're gearing up to do that right now.
That's exactly right. And that decision is enormously unpopular with the American people. Polls show that 70-80% of Americans oppose that decision. So it's a very populist theme that you're seeing this president strike, and you're going to see this continue throughout this confirmation and process and during these confirmation hearings. I think you're going to see Democratic senators really try to portray the Republican, a dominated conservative Supreme Court is out of touch and in the pocket of big business and not listening to the ordinary little guy.
Here's Republican Arizona Senator John Kyle on Sunday on ABC's This Week, being interviewed by Jake Tapper on the confirmation hearings ahead and the possibility of a Republican filibuster.
President Obama himself attempted to filibuster Justice Alito, who now sits on the Supreme Court. So if the president isn't going to take it off the table, I'm not going to take it off the table. But I think it can easily be avoided by appointing, frankly, the kind of person that Senator Schumer just mentioned, someone who is mainstream enough that with intellect and the application of good law can persuade colleagues to support his position or her position.
Arizona Senator John Kyle, Republican, on Sunday. Jan Crawford, what about this issue of who's activist now on the court?
Well, first of all, I have to say, does Senator Kyle really want a nominee from the left who's going to be able to persuade Justice Kennedy to join his position? I don't think so. If you're a Republican, you want someone who's really far right, who's going to drive the key moderate Justice Kennedy, who's kind of like
swing
this
vote.
Human jump ball. You want someone to push away, but of course you're not going to say that. And, when you talk about activism and mainstream, I go back to what Jeff said earlier, that's really in the way that you define it. What John Kyle defines as mainstream is going to be very different than what Chuck Schumer defines as mainstream. That said, I think this White House is looking for a nominee who is going to be a reliable, solid vote on the left and who can affect change on that court. If we look back to what the president did with his nomination of Sonia Sotomayor, who, of course, was replacing David Souter, not the same kind of pivotal leader that Justice Stevens has been, he really thought politically. He did not look at that court or that pick as a strategic pick and what impact she would have on the Supreme Court. I think now the White House, at least my sources tell me, that this is going to be much more important. They realize they're replacing John Paul Stevens, and they're looking for someone who will be a more strategic pick in terms of the impact that they could have on the court. But now that, if you're a Republican, that puts you in a between a rock and a hard place. That's not necessarily what you want.
Jeffrey Rosen, of course, there's two kinds of strategy here, and one is just to get through confirmation hearings, and the other is the long game about shaping the court's view of the Constitution, American life, and really shaping American society over the long haul. Where do you see President Obama going in those terms with his nominee?
When he made his announcement from the Rose Garden, he said that appointing a justice is the most important responsibility I have. And, of course, he's a former constitutional law professor who's thought more carefully about these issues than any president in this century. So one senses that he really would want to affect the future of the court. Now, it's striking and encouraging that the leading names on the short list right now, the ones that are talked about most frequently, are all both superb. They're scholarly. They're respected by liberal and conservative academics, and each has the possibility, in different ways, really to lead the liberal wing for the next couple decades. Now they're quite different.
Go down that list.
Sure. Merrick Garland on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit is a tremendously respected, moderate-minded judge. Some call him the John Roberts of the left. He would have the easiest confirmation hearings. In fact, some Republican activists have already said that they would support him because he's perceived as a judge's judge and not someone who's really on any kind of ideological crusade. In the middle, politically, is Elena Kagan, the U.S. Solicitor General. She was the former dean of Harvard Law School, where she again won the respect of conservative academics as well as liberals. She's considered a brilliant strategist, and she does have some positions that conservatives are ready to jump on. Her position on Don't Ask, Don't Tell and on the Defense of Marriage Act as Solicitor General. But
gay rights issues.
Exactly so. But she would claim that she's just defending federal laws as she's required to as Solicitor General. And broadly, she'd be hard to caricature as a wild ideologue, although indeed some Republicans might try. And then the third name on the list, Diane Wood, who's a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, the same court that Justice Stevens came from. And with that Chicago connection and the fact that she also knows President Obama from the University of Chicago, there's a sort of sentimental appropriateness to that. She's considered the most liberal of the candidates and the one who would most inflame the Republican opposition. She has some very strong opinions having to do with abortion protests and abortion rights, freedom of church and state, the Pledge of Allegiance. And essentially, if President Obama wanted someone who would delight progressives and the left legal community and inflame conservatives, she would definitely be the one. But it is striking that all three of those candidates are just considered to be first rate within the legal community. Each has the position to be an intellectual leader. And broadly, this position of activism is going to be very hard to push on them because all three of those candidates believe in upholding federal laws, from campaign finance reform to health care to financial regulation, and they think that those national debates should be fought in the political process. The Republicans really are going to be in the position, both the Tea Party Republicans and the Senate Republicans, of saying, Judge, you're an activist unless you reverse our political defeats and strike down the laws that we were unable to block in Congress. And that is, regardless of the political appeal of that, maybe 20% of the country buys that sort of message, it's a topsy-turvy definition of activism that's going to be very hard to sustain over the long haul.
I mean, the charge now, Jan, is that it's the conservatives on the court who have become the real activists in recent cases on gun rights and on campaign spending, seeing corporations and unions as equivalent to individuals when it comes to free speech. Justice Stevens himself is essentially making this charge of activism on the right.
That's exactly right, and certainly my friend Jeff has written quite extensively about this. But I think where conservatives come down on this court, and especially the Chief Justice, Justice Alito, is that on some of these issues, it's not their role to lead the country. Yes, they're striking down laws that the Constitution makes pretty clear unconstitutional, but they're also going to let the legislatures pass laws that aren't directly unconstitutional, whether it's on abortion or gay rights. And so their philosophy, which we saw the Chief Justice talk quite extensively about in his confirmation hearing, is that the founders of our great nation didn't spill all of this blood so courts could make all of these hard decisions. I think it was very frustrating to progressives to see Justice Sotomayor, during her confirmation hearing, fail to really articulate the liberal perspective on how to interpret the Constitution that we've seen, say, Justice Breyer so articulate and eloquently explain. And I think, as Jeff points out, the top three candidates on the short list at this point all would be very capable of doing that, and all would be very capable of going kind of toe-to-toe with some of the top leaders of the right now on the Supreme Court, all highly respected, would be all very difficult for Republicans to block. I would say that I don't think that Diane Wood, though. I'm going to disagree a little bit with Jeff.
Out of Chicago.
I don't think that yes, I don't think that she can be characterized as some leftist who should inflame conservatives. She's very respected. She was obviously an official. She taught antitrust law when I was at the University of Chicago, a law school. She's very highly regarded by the courts, the Seventh Circuit's two leading conservatives, kind of dominant conservative thinkers, Richard Posner and Frank Easterbrook. So I would not characterize her as some kind of crazy leftist. She also, I think, could be seen almost as moderate. To her great misfortune, though, she's been sitting on that federal appeals court out there on the Seventh Circuit, and she's had to confront some of these difficult issues that, say, Elena Kagan hasn't, because she hasn't been on the bench. Her confirmation in 1992 never got acted on. And Merrick Garland, you don't get those kind of issues on the D.C. Circuit. So at any rate, I think all of these nominees would be very difficult for Republicans to block. And if I could go back to something that we were kind of setting this up, the narrative that the Supreme Court is out of touch with everyday Americans, that the White House is going to continue to push, Diane Wood would be the only justice who did not attend the Ivy League institutions. Mm-hmm. She's University of Texas undergrad, University of Texas Law School. She's been a working mom. She has a very compelling personal story. Now, Merrick Garland left a partnership at a law firm to go be a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office, also a compelling story. And, of course, Elena Kagan defended that campaign finance law that opened the floodgates, as they put it, for corporate and union spending. She defended the law as Solicitor General.
Jeffrey, I may, can I get a call right here, and we'll come to you with all of that, if I may, from Nashville. Charles, you're on the air, Charles.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned about the Obama administration's weakness when it comes to allowing the Republicans to put him on the defense on every issue. If Barack Obama doesn't nominate a strong, progressive candidate, if he's apologetic, and if he don't fight, it's better for Obama to lose this battle and drag it on than for him to pick a moderate, a weak person, looking at the court today. And I'm concerned with just the conversation I'm hearing, the use of branding people liberal, leftist, or conservative. Conservative boasts about being conservative. No one in politics, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, no one except that label, the media's. The media put their label, brand people, their label, the conservative brand people. I wish the media would stop using that term. If someone doesn't admit to being a liberal, you're defeating the cause by branding this justice a liberal when he's clearly not, and he says he's not.
Charles, we've got the perspective loud and clear, and I appreciate it. Jeffrey Rosen, I mean, you hear right there the call to the president. Don't be on the defense, says Charles here anyway. Don't try and split the difference so much that you don't get somebody who represents, if he has it, that progressive view of what the court ought to be.
I think Charles's caution is excellent and well taken. And I agree with him, too, that it's a shame that we are forced to talk about candidates in these caricatured terms. In that sense, Jan, I certainly didn't mean to suggest for a second that Diane Wood was a crazy, out-of-touch liberal. On the contrary, she's one of the most thoughtful and principled judges on the circuit today. The point is that this is the way that she will be caricatured by conservatives, some of whom have already told me and have written in blogs that out of the three candidates, they're going to go after her the most. Now, Charles says...
Well, point
President
taken.
Obama,
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, no, I don't endorse that view in any way. Charles says President Obama shouldn't be cowed by this, and I agree with him. This is not a time to compromise. But the question is, what sort of justice does Obama want? I think he wants the justice who will be most influential over the long term in articulating a liberal vision and persuading Justice Kennedy and others to come around to his side. And the truth is, this shortlist is so strong that there are cases to be made for each of the three candidates. And Charles, I think you're right that rather than talking about them in right, left, and center, let's compare the fact that Elena Kagan really has a strategic ability to talk to conservatives and bring them over to her side. Diane Wood has written that judges should be in a conversation with the political branches, and rather than presuming to make policy on their own, they should essentially nudge society in a more progressive direction, but never lead them. And that vision is quite consistent with what Professor Obama said in his book, The Audacity of Hope, where he said that liberals had relied too much on the courts to fight their battles for them, and essentially they should realize that politics rather than judicial decisions should determine the progressive position. And finally, Merrick Garland, so thoughtful, a judge's judge, and I think he's also misunderstood. If people think that he'd be some sort of cautious moderate, he's just got an incredibly sharp mind, and on questions like terrorism and criminal procedure, places where on the current court, Justice Stevens really was almost a unique voice, someone like Garland would be a worthy successor and really protect individual rights in a great way.
We're looking at the Supreme Court after John Paul Stevens. Let me get a call from Acton, Massachusetts. And Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. The conversation has been skewed since Stevens' announcement to the point where conventional wisdom is that the president needs to nominate someone to the right of a fellow who was appointed by a Republican president, Gerald Ford. And the only reason we find ourselves in that position is because of the unprecedented possibility that an associate justice nominee will be denied an up or down vote. And I think it's important to note how unconstitutional it is and how unprecedented it is. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2 says the president shall nominate with the advice and consent of the Senate. There's no mention of a filibuster. There's nothing in the Constitution that that contemplates it. And no Democratic Congress has ever denied an up or down vote to a presidential nominee to the Supreme Court.
Mark, we've got it. I appreciate your call. I appreciate your raising that issue. We're joined right now for a few minutes by from Chicago by John McGinnis, professor of law at Northwestern University. Professor McGinnis, thanks very much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
You have perhaps a more conservative view of the court and affairs. You hear our caller right there saying, no filibuster, please, it would be wrong. What about precedent there and the possibility of a filibuster this time out, Professor?
Well, I think it's very important to consider the filibuster not whether one's a conservative or liberal, but to think whether this is going to produce better justices. And I've actually on record to saying that a filibuster is good. It's good when there's a Republican president. It's good when there is a Democratic president, or at least to have the possibility of a
Why?
Filibuster. And the reason for that is that moves justices towards the center, that the president is generally, of either party, is going to nominate someone at the median of his party, which is actually somewhat away from the median voter. And what the filibuster, the possibility of it does, is force him to nominate someone towards the center. And I think that's very good, particularly if you have a pragmatic view of what justices do, that they actually just simply don't operate on the basis of neutral legal principles, but take into account various considerations of the public mind. It's better to have centrists. And so I actually think there's a principled argument for the filibuster, whether or not it's a Republican or a Democrat.
Jeffrey Rosen, what do you make of that? And do you see the possibility, the real possibility of a filibuster this time?
I don't. I guess in theory it's an interesting argument, but in practice, when you have Republicans who are painting as extremists, even obviously moderate candidates who are at the center of their party, like Elena Kagan, distorting their positions and painting them as judicial activists when they're not, then the real effect of a filibuster would mean gridlock and a complete breakdown. And of course, the Democrats will also say President Bush did not choose moderate candidates when he had the chance to appoint them. Sam Alito certainly has moved the court very much to the right. John Roberts talked about moderation in his confirmation hearings, but Senate Democrats are very upset with that Citizens United decision, which they feel meant that Roberts mischaracterized himself as a moderate who cared about precedent in his confirmation hearings. So right now, I there are some Republicans who have forsworn the filibuster. My prediction, for what it's worth, is that this nominee is not going to be filibustered and will get through. But the idea that the threat of a filibuster would produce more moderate nominees when you have a short list, which by Democratic standards is about as moderate as Republicans could possibly hope, doesn't seem convincing to me.
Jan, we just got 20 seconds
before. Maybe that it is a moderate list precisely because there is the threat of the filibuster in the background. So I'm not actually disputing that many of these nominees are moderate nominees. But the reason we don't see more radical nominees may be that it's all done in the shadow of the possibility of a filibuster if there were an extreme nomination.
We've got to take a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jeffrey Rosen, I wish you'd describe for us the role that John Paul Stevens has played. When people say he's been the leader of the liberal wing of the court, in practice, what has that meant? And can a successor pick up that role, or who does it fall to now?
It falls immediately to the senior liberal associate justice, the longest-serving one, who in this case would be Justice Ginsburg, who's been on longer than everyone else. Here's how it works procedurally. Basically, the justices all take a vote around the table, and if the Chief Justice is in the majority, in other words, the group that has five votes, he can either write the decision himself or assign it to the justice he thinks will best reflect his views. But if he's in the minority, and there's a liberal majority, then the senior liberal justice in the majority, who has been Stevens because he's the longest serving, gets to do the same thing, be as a shadow chief justice, either write it himself or assign it to the person who will best reflect his views. So Stevens told me in the interview, you know, sometimes he has to pick the person who's on the fence, and that's often Justice Kennedy. in order to ensure that Kennedy will stay with the liberals. So it was Stevens who asked Kennedy to write that very important decision in 2003, recognizing gay rights and striking down sodomy laws.
Mm-hmm.
And in the decision involving women's rights a couple years ago, he chose Justice Ginsburg to protest against the narrow construction of a federal law about discrimination. So that's a strategic choice that he makes. He also has to make strategic choices about when to hear a case. Stevens decided not to hear a terrorism case for a couple of years until he was confident Kennedy was on his side, and then he voted to hear it. So that sort of internal politicking, that savvy, is just crucial. No one can replace him by virtue of the dint of his experience. The new justice won't be senior, but the new justice can combine this laser-sharp legal mind that Stevens has with a pragmatic sense of when to compromise and who's best likely to take the liberal position. And I think Stevens' final great dissent, the Citizens United dissent, this tour de force of an angry attack on the conservatives for their activism on every score, just shows the depth of his talents, and in that sense he really will be hard to replace.
I want to talk about this activism question some more, but Jan, I've just got a technical question here. With Stevens' departure, I think the next longest serving justice is Antonin Scalia. So does that role, it doesn't fall to him, though? The court sort of divides into teams here or partisan
wings?
Well,
no. And when we were discussing this earlier, where Scalia will step up now is during the private conference when they're discussing their decisions and how they're going to vote. He won't have any effect on the opinion assigning, as Jeff explained, but he will get to talk after the Chief Justice. So you're not going to have a strong liberal voice in that private conference when the Chief Justice explains his position. Justice Stevens had gone next and provided that counterpoint. Now Justice Scalia will do that. So you're going to have back-to-back arguments, presumably for the conservative side, as the justices sit around and discuss their views.
Well, John McGinnis, the case has been made that the conservative justices on the court have now become the activist justices on the court. You're a conservative yourself. How do you see that?
I don't see it that way. And of course, it depends what you mean by activism. If you simply define activism to mean striking down all legislation, there may be some modicum of truth to that, although I think it's pretty even once you include both state and federal legislation, or not dramatically different. But that's not how I understand the way activism should be understood. It should be mean activism is when you are not faithful to the meaning of the Constitution, and I don't believe that the conservatives are more activist in that sense. And indeed, I believe two of them, Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, are almost the definition of what I would consider as non-activist judges, as following the original meaning of the Constitution, at least unless it's clearly countermanded by a substantial line of precedent.
Jeffrey Rosen, Justice Stevens has been very firm in saying it's not just the original tent that should be brought into effect, but all of American history and all of that evolution. How does he define judicial activism now?
Justice Stevens embraces the traditional understanding of activism, which is that judges should not short-circuit political debates and reverse laws that don't clearly violate constitutional limitations. And it is true, as John McGinnis says, it all depends on the meaning of activism, to use a Clintonian phrase. But if you just take the definition that conservatives attacked liberals for 50 years, the definition was clear. They said, liberals, you are losing political debates, and then you're running to the courts to reverse them and to give you things that you can't win politically. And by that definition, that's exactly what conservatives are doing on health care, on campaign finance, and on financial regulation. Justice Stevens, interestingly, as you say, Tom, believe that judges should look not just at the original understanding, although that's important, but at the whole scope of American history. And it's so moving and striking that in his decisions, he would actually cite examples from World War II, from the Depression era, that he himself remembered. He talked about in a case involving student speech. He talked about prohibition and the debate over that, which he himself recalled. More recently, in the campaign finance case, he said, in World War II, this would be like equating the speech of Tokyo Rose during World War II with that of pro-Allied speech. So he was able to speak from personal experience when he talked about the whole scope of American history. And in that sense, he's an inspiring model for the next generation of liberals who obviously won't be as old as he, but can resist the narrow claim that original understanding is all that matters and instead see constitutional principles much more broadly.
Jan, that raises the issue of the background round of justices on the Supreme Court. As you pointed out, with his departure, all would have attended Harvard or Yale. You know, that's pretty narrow. I think he was the last veteran, including all the Republican nominees. He signed up, enlisted in World War II on December 6, 1941, the day before Pearl Harbor, won a Bronze Star for his work in cryptography. But what about this issue of
who's... codebreaker.
Codebreaker, exactly, and quite an important one. What about this issue of who serves on the court and the sort of skinnying down of the sources of nominees that's occurred?
Well, I think that you're always going to see, and certainly we already are, these calls for someone who's outside the, quote, judicial monastery, as someone who's, you know, lived a life, a politician, someone who understands people or and people's concerns and didn't just have this kind of elite background and then go into the world of academia or, say, you know, coming off the federal appeals court, because now the Supreme Court will have all former federal appeals court judges serving as justices. But that's very difficult to do in practice. Presidents want to do that, but when you start looking at possible nominees, possible former politicians or, you know, people who are in corporate worlds, there's, you know, the rough and tumble world of politics. And in this hypercharged political environment, even the slightest, say, campaign finance contribution that is questionable can be turned into some kind of ethics charge. And so that's why they tend to go back to people who've led these squeaky clean lives and have been federal judges, or because of the confirmation process now becoming so explosive and so difficult to get through, really since the 1980s with Robert Bork. Remember, when Justice Stevens was nominated, he was confirmed 19 days later and the vote was 98-0. Those times have changed, I don't have to say. And the White House, this White House, is very, very keenly aware of this. Anyway, if I could just go back to the point about filibuster, I don't think a filibuster is off the table at all. Republicans would certainly filibuster someone who would make the left very excited and someone who would be considered a strong progressive, say someone like Harold Coe, the dean of Yale Law School, is now the legal advisor in the State Department. And I think, as John points out, that's why we're somewhat seeing, partly why we're seeing this list, as a little more moderate than someone who's really sharply on the left. And when we talk about filibuster, remember, there are long memories in the Senate. What goes around comes around. President Obama voted to filibuster Sam Alito. So Republicans feel like they've got some moral ground here to filibuster if the nominee is very progressive.
Let's go to Radonna in Waterloo, Iowa. Radonna, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm Radonna Parker from Waterloo, and I was listening to some of your other callers in, and they were discussing the conservatism and liberal views.
Yes.
In discussion of your next Supreme Court pick. My question, or I take offense with more liberal politicians say, everybody hiding from the label of liberal. Isn't the root of liberal liberty? It's because of liberalism that we have had Supreme Court laws. We've had Medicare and Medicaid. We've had the new health care bill. We've had child labor laws, women's rights laws. What is wrong with being liberal?
Are you confident that President Obama will nominate a Supreme Court nominee who sort of carries that view of the world, Radonna?
I hope he nominates someone who will uphold the supremacy of federal law. Recently, I was reading Slavery by Another Name, and I was reading about the Jim Crow laws, and it's really funny that the more conservative and southern states always want to uphold state law over federal law, and that is because then they don't have to succumb to the rulings of our federal law. State laws over federal laws that kept us in a Jim Crow state.
Radonna, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Jeffrey Rosen, the three that we've described here is on a short list. Are they going to carry this flag that a couple of callers have now come in saying, please, President Obama, put it out there?
They will, and I think Radonna is so correct to note that historical reality, that it's been claims of resisting federal law in the name of states' rights that's led to some of the greatest attacks on liberty and throughout American history. And it's not a surprise that in this fight over the health care bill, not only are Tea Party conservatives claiming that it's unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause, but several states have actually passed resolutions calling for the nullification of federal law, refusing to follow the mandate, just the way states did after the Brown versus Board of Education decision and before the Civil War. So this question, you know, let's leave aside the labels rules about activism or not. The question is, will all of these nominees be strongly progressive in the sense of feeling that things like health care, fair economic regulation, and so forth, those should be upheld if they come from the political system rather from the courts? And all of the nominees would be very deferential on those scores. And the truth is, the real reason that these nominees are more moderate, I think it's not the fear of the fear of the filibuster. It's that Republicans want something different out of the courts that Democrats do. This is a progressive age. All of these good progressive laws are emerging from Congress. All Democrats want is for courts to get out of the way and for allow Congress to work its will and protect liberty in this way. They also want civil liberties to be protected when it comes to the war on terror and criminal rights. But whereas Republicans have a much more radical vision of the courts, they want to overturn all of these great national laws, and they also want to be much more deferential when it comes to terrorism. So I think the caller is precisely correct about that, and all three of those nominees are likely to be restrained on those issues of economic regulation and health care and so forth.
Let's get a call from Washington, D.C. Sheila, you're on the air, Sheila.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
I guess, well, I told the call screener, I do want a judge who gets back to the Constitution. I think that from the left and the right, for all these years, we have been propagandized and manipulated and controlled, and we're getting bled dry now, again, from both the left and the right.
But what does it mean to get back to the Constitution? Does it mean taking into account all the years of interpretation, or just back to 1770, you name it?
We're supposed to be a republic of states. We're supposed to have limited federal government. We're supposed to have individual liberties. I think each side has forgotten about big chunks of that all this time. Without the individual liberties, where are we?
Sheila, we've got it. Our time is short, but we've got it very loud and clear there. There's the tension right there, Jan, between these last two callers and where their emphasis is. Who do you think is going to be more satisfied by the nominee President Obama puts forward?
Well, I agree with Jeff that I think the three on the short list will be very strategic and very capable, very highly regarded, and would be quite effective on that Supreme Court and leading that Supreme Court for a generation. I think the frustration that you're hearing, though, and is palpable, I think, is that here is our the left, here's the chance. The Senate will not get any better than this. President Obama has a solid majority, and Democrats are expected to lose at least 4 to 6 seats in the upcoming midterms. So, if not now, when? And so that's why you hear this cry, I think, for this strong progressive voice who can articulate the role of the courts from the left in a way that John Roberts has been able to do on the right and Scalia has been able to do on the right. But I agree with Jeff that I think while these three may seem or being tagged as more moderate, I think they would be capable of doing that.
John McGinnis, we've just got a minute here, but in these three, Kagan, Garland, Diane Wood, the so-called shortlist, do you see grounds for a filibuster from a conservative perspective?
I doubt there would be a filibuster in any of these cases. I think Wood would be the most least likely acceptable to people who have an originalist view of the Constitution. I also think she's would raise culture war issues by her rulings on abortion. My sense is, I think one thing that's not been fully understood, at least so far in the conversation I've heard, it's not at all clear to me that Obama shares the progressives' view that the court is the focus of social change. I think while Obama is quite to the left, I think there's some indications, even in his writings, that he's doubtful that the court is that locus. And so his calculus may be to more compromise here precisely because he has a very large agenda of political matters that he wants to go before Congress and doesn't want to spend a lot of political capital here.
Well, I'm sure we'll be talking a lot more about this over the summer. I'm very grateful to each of you for being with us today. John McGinnis at Northwestern University in Chicago. John, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Jeffrey Rosen at George Washington University. Thank you very much, Jeffrey, for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
And Jan Crawford, Chief Legal Correspondent at CBS News, author of Supreme Conflict. Jan, thanks as always for being here.
You're welcome, Tom. Thank you.
Northwestern University, I should say there, Evanston, Illinois. Listeners, before we close today, I want to mention an important follow-up to our show last Monday on Pope Benedict and the current crisis facing the Vatican. One of our show's guests, Notre Dame historian Scott Appleby, leveled some pretty serious charges on the show against Bill Keller, executive editor of the New York Times. Bill Keller has responded, and now, in case you've missed it, there is a remarkable exchange between the Times top editor and the Notre Dame historian at our website, onpointradio.org. I'd really encourage you to check it out. It's very interesting. And while you're there, you might be interested in video of a debate I recently moderated between atheist Christopher Hitchens and Rabbi David Volpe, the so-called Great God Debate. It's also posted at the site. You can continue our conversations and get the On Point podcast at that website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gale Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, and John Wibby, with help from Shireen Jafari and Case Wickman. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.